Barber, who's helping to lead the new Poor People's Campaign, challenging systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and ecological devastation, next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Is Home Birthright for Me? On Sunday, April 15th at 5 p.m. at the Northeast Whole Foods Market in Portland, 3535 Northeast 15th Avenue. Local home birth midwives will show the film, Why Not Home, followed by a QA session with the midwives. Again, that's Is Home Birthright for Me? On Sunday, April 15th at 5 p.m. at Whole Foods Market, 3535 Northeast 15th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KBOO's history.
KBOO, I really think, is a good resource, and they give a voice to people who might be isolated or disfranchised. I thought that was good how they put it in their mission statement.
KBOO was a lot of activity, and I was struck by the diversity. It was very welcoming. And I thought, this is something I like to be involved with.
The day I walked in, it was during pledge drive, and I was immediately pulled over to the membership drive table, which was in the front lobby, and we were all talking on the air about why you should join KBOO. And it was fun.
To hear the stories of people who helped make KBOO what it is today, go to 50yearsofkboo.fm and click on KBOO Stories Project.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art in Portland. This concert is a collaboration of the Camas High School Choir, indie rock musician Kelly Pratt, and young audiences of Oregon and Southwest Washington. The concert is an original hour-long performance for a rock band, horns, and 200 high school singers, blending together a wide array of styles and genres. Again, that's Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art, 15 Northeast Hancock Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we bring you the powerful words of the Reverend Dr. William Barber II, speaking on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, April 4th, from the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. As well as part of Dr. Barber's talk honoring the life and legacy of Dr. King's commitment to social justice and civil liberty, given at the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Reverend Barber is one of the joint coordinators, along with the Reverend Liz Theo Harris, of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Donald Trump is taunting Russia on Twitter this morning about an upcoming U.S. missile strike on Syria. Trump tweeted, quote, Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming nice and new and smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills his people and enjoys it, Trump tweeted. Russian lawmakers say their country would view a U.S. airstrike on Syria as a war crime. that could trigger a direct military clash between the two nations. Russia's ambassador to Lebanon went even further, saying any missiles fired at Syria would be shot down and the launching sites targeted. Russia's foreign ministry said the so-called smart missiles that Trump is threatening to bomb Syria with will destroy evidence of a suspected chemical weapons attack. The Syrian government said Trump threats to attack it are reckless and endanger international peace and security. The United Nations Health Agency says reports from its partners indicate some 500 patients showed signs of exposure to toxic chemicals following shelling on the Syrian town of Douma over the weekend. People familiar with the investigation say federal agents who raided the office of Donald Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, were looking for information about payments to a former Playboy playmate and a porn actress who claimed to have had affairs with Trump. They say prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan are trying to determine if there was any fraud related to the payments to Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. The new details on the Cohen raid emerged as Trump boiled over on Twitter about it and evidence that investigators are zeroing in on his inner circle. The White House defiantly claimed that Trump has the power to directly fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller despite Justice Department rules that say otherwise. Here's spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I know a number of individuals in the legal community and including at the Department of Justice said he has the power to do so, but I don't have any further announcements on.
On Twitter this morning, Trump says Mueller is, quote, most conflicted of all except Rosenstein, who signed FISA and Comey letter. No collusion, so they go crazy, Trump tweeted. A bipartisan group of four senators is moving to protect Mueller's job. Republican Senators Tom Tillis and Lindsey Graham and Democrats Chris Coons and Cory Booker are introducing legislation today that would give any special counsel a 10-day window in which he or she could seek expedited judicial review of a firing. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan is set to announce this morning he will not run for re-election. That's according to multiple media reports. Ryan's plans have been the source of much speculation amid Republican concerns over keeping their majority in the House of Representatives. He is a powerful fundraiser for Republicans. No word on why he's planning not to seek re-election. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg faces more congressional questioning. Today, it's the turn of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Senators grilled Zuckerberg for 5 hours yesterday. They accused him of failing to protect the personal information of 87 million people whose data was mined by Cambridge Analytica to help Donald Trump's re-election campaign, and then failing to let them know their information was compromised. California Senator Kamala Harris.
I'm also concerned that when you personally became aware of this, did you or senior leadership do an inquiry to find out who at Facebook had this information, and did they not have a discussion about whether or not the users should be informed back in December of 2015?
Senator, in retrospect, I think we clearly view it as a mistake that we didn't inform people.
The controversy has brought a flood of bad publicity and sent the company's stock value plunging, but Zuckerberg seemed to achieve a measure of success in countering that. Facebook shares surged 4.5% for the day, the biggest gain in 2 years. A Bank of America executive says the financial giant will stop lending money to gun manufacturers that make military-inspired firearms for civilian use, such as the AR-15. The announcement is the latest success for gun violence prevention groups since the Valentine's Day high school massacre in Parkland, Florida. Yvonne Staples, whose voice and business acumen powered the success of the Staples Singers, has died at the age of 80. Her family's hit-making gospel group topped the charts in the early 1970s with the song, I'll Take You There. Yvonne Staples performed with her sisters, Mavis and Cleotha, and their father, Pops. The family was active in civil rights and performed at the request of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Her family says Staples died at her home in Chicago. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines, and now on to the words of the Reverend William Barber, a joint coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. This is the speech he gave to honor the work on social justice and civil liberty of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. It was given at the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City on January 14th, 2018. Let us now go to the Reverend William Barber.
In this moment on this King Day, all over this nation, many, some will come to King celebrations who would not even welcome him if he was alive. So we got to be careful, y'all. The best way to destroy and distort the legacy and message of a prophet is to revision them as perfect and popular. This year especially, we need to remember the real Martin Luther King, who found himself having to take on a society he properly diagnosed as having a neurotic sickness and a septic commitment to racism, poverty, and militarism that was destroying its soul and ripping it apart, its moral promises and its moral possibilities. When he rendered this diagnosis and committed to raise a poor people's campaign with those who had nothing to lose, those who were the only ones that might have the moral and spiritual capacity to turn the nation's conscience and character toward the way of love, truth, and justice, when he did that, he was declared an enemy of the state. A lot of clergy left him. A lot of friends left him. He was declared an enemy of the state. To the powers that be. Why? Because as the prophet Amos once said, prophetic talk of love and justice that dares to challenge arrogance and greed and injustice is never welcomed by the oppressive forces and the oppressive systems, especially when the oppressor has a prescribed type of protest and a set of issues that they will accept you talking about. But when Dr. King linked racism and poverty and war and dared to challenge not just laws of the state and country, but the nation itself, he was not popular. And any attempt to simply popularize him, make a commodity out of him, throw celebratory and commemorative platitudes at him without embracing, embodying, and engaging the prophetic vision and call to action that he espoused is actually to participate in the destruction of his legacy. To talk about how he went to jail and not be willing to go yourself is to demean and dismiss all the poor people that took up his call. It is to commit the sin that Jesus once spoke of, which is to love the tomb of the prophets, but not the prophets when they are alive. Jesus understood that this was a form of ever-diminishing hypocrisy that renders any claim to really loving the prophet false. So America, be careful how we say we love Dr. King. Now, to be sure, my brothers and sisters, we've always had to fight to maintain a proper sense of self, because America has always struggled with knowing who she is. Sister Nell Painter, the Princeton professor, says that we've always had this call and response. The call for justice for a moment, America seems to get her head together. Then America loses her mind. America has had a kind of split personality. At times, political and social schizophrenia, a great gulf between what she dreams to be and what she is in reality. One of the hymns that we sing about America loses that it says, America, America, God mend thine every flaw. America has been a nation that has had what Dr. King once called a high blood pressure of creeds and the anemia of deeds. Langston Hughes said, but I swear this oath, America will be, and yet America has never been America to me. But I swear this oath, America will be. Yes, there has been progress in America, but this has only come when those who knew who they were and who America should be dared to challenge this country and not give up on her possibilities. We have a nation that is great, yet it's a nation that has great struggles, because what she says in words too often contradicts what she is in action. And for those of us who want so much for her to live out the true meaning of her creed, to move this nation closer to where her words and deeds match, we must know who we are. And part of that means we must know the radical king. You know, I'm talking about the king that talked like this. We've deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant work ethic and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the back of the exploitation and suffering of black slaves and the genocide of Native Americans, and continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black, red, and white, both here and abroad. That king, my good friend Cornel West helps us here when he says that Martin Luther King Jr. refused to sell his soul for a mess of pottage. He refused to silence his voice in a quest for unarmed truth and unconditional love for King. The condition of truth was to allow suffering to speak for him. Justice was what love looked like in public. In King's eyes, too many people sacrificed the truth for access to power or reduced sacrificial love and service to selfish expediency and personal gain. The radical King sided with the poor and the working people in a class struggle taking place in capitalistic society. He always, Dr. West says, had a healthy suspicion of politicians of any color. Any color. We need to know the king who understood the connections of history. We need to understand the king who said, I'd rather be dead than afraid. Because he saw too many people being afraid. They knew what was right, but they were afraid in their pulpits, afraid in their places of work, afraid wherever to stand up for what's right. You know, you almost have to check now when people say they marched with Dr. King. Because there's a whole lot of marching going on now. But the pictures don't show it when you look in the past. We need to know the king who understood the connection of history. King had a deep analysis of America. He was not shallow. You know, too many people right now are having a shallow argument in this moment. We've never seen this before. What? We've never seen America and its leadership contradict what it says on paper. We've never seen people get elected and lose the popular vote. You must not know about Rutherford B. Hayes in 1877. We've never seen all out racism in the Oval Office. Then you've forgotten about Woodrow Wilson when he played Birth of a Nation in the Oval Office. No, Dr. King would say, no, there's a pattern of call and response in American history. In fact, in 1965, at the end of the Selma to Montgomery march, a speech, Dr. Forbes, that people don't often talk about, that speech at the end of the Selma to Montgomery, listen what he said, and it's almost a diagnosis for the moment we're in now. Listen, this is Dr. King. He said, if it may be said of the slavery era that the white man took the world and gave the Negro Jesus, then it may be said of the Reconstruction era that the Southern aristocracy took the world and gave the poor white man Jim Crow. He gave him Jim Crow, and when his wrinkled stomach cried out for food that his empty pockets couldn't provide, instead of the white aristocracy helping the poor man, he gave him Jim Crow. He ate Jim Crow, a psychological bird that told him no matter how bad off he was, at least he was a white man, better than a black man. He ate Jim Crow, and when his undernourished children cried out for the necessities that his low wage could not provide, the aristocracy was afraid of him connecting with black and brown people, so he showed them the Jim Crow signs on the buses and in the stores and on the street and in the public buildings. And his children too learned to feed upon Jim Crow, their last outpost of psychological oblivion. Thus, the threat, said Dr. King, of the free exercise of the ballot by Negroes and white people coming together resulted in the establishment of a segregated society that was fostered by the aristocracy. They segregated Southern money from poor whites. They segregated Southern morals from the rich whites. They segregated Southern churches from Christianity. They segregated Southern minds from honest thinking. They segregated the Negro from everything. That's what happened when the Negro and white masses of the South threatened to unite and build a great society. This is not new. Since the publication of Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury, pundits and politicians have questioned President Trump's mental stability, provoking the Twitter-in-chief to retort that he is a stable genius. Now, I leave mental health diagnoses to healthcare professionals. I'm partly a trained counselor. But we would do well to heed King's prophetic diagnosis of our shared moral malady. Indeed, we cannot honor King without addressing the spiritual sickness that has produced extremism in state houses, in the U.S. Congress, and in the present administration. What we are seeing is not just the problem of a person. And we do ourselves a disservice, and we do not honor the deep analysis of Dr. King to limit our analysis to just one person. In his final sermon on the evening of April 3rd, as the thunderstorms outside the church echoed, Dr. King said, "The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion is all around." This diagnosis was rooted in his assessment that America had never fully repented of her original sin of race-based chattel slavery and genocide. Reconstruction was an attempt, but Reconstruction's promise was undermined by the redemption movement that arose to push back progress, and the redemption movement that sought to undermine black and white people working together and forward progress also said they were redeeming America to make it great again. The Supreme Court of the United States made separate but equal the law of the land. When Dr. King stood on the National Mall August 28, 1963, to describe the nightmare of Jim Crow and white supremacy, he mourned. You remember? 100 years later, he said, "Systemic racism was inextricably tied to economic system that kept millions of people in poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world." Dr. King saw more and more clearly. What he saw were the flip side of a military-industrial complex that demanded resources to kill black and brown people in other parts of the world. So Dr. King, joined with Native elders and sharecroppers and welfare rights organizers and farm workers and poor white people from Appalachia and gang members from northern ghettos, to mount a poor people's campaign that would demand a Marshall Plan for America's poor black, white, brown, and red people, because he saw a deeper sickness. And I tell you, my friend, whatever Donald Trump's mental state, 60 million Americans were willing to entrust him and entrust our government to him after they heard the extremism of his policy proposal. And a majority in the House and Senate have demonstrated that they are willing to work with him to take health care away from millions. That's not about a person. When you literally will look in people's eyes and say, "Elect me so I can take your health care and let you die." America is sick. When there are 100 million, not 47 million poor folk, 100 million poor and working poor people. And we had 26 presidential debates, Democrat and Republican, and not 1 hour on poverty. In any debate, Democrat or Republican, when we have 14 million poor children in this country over 150 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. More than 250,000 people die every year from poverty, more than from heart attack, stroke, and cancer. When we have in Congress a kind of mean-spirited presidential cabinet of billionaires and a mean-spirited Congress, where even Paul Ryan had the nerve to say feeding a hungry child with free lunch robs them of their soul. And they will deny raising the minimum wage, but give corporate welfare and tax cuts to the greedy. That is not just about one person. We didn't just catch a cold. This sickness has been infused into our common life. We've been poisoned by division and racism and classism. If you knew America like Dr. King knew America, you would know the difference between, for instance, losing a fair fight and getting cheated. It was not Donald Trump that led those 26 states from 2010 to now to pass voter suppression laws. It was not Trump that allowed state houses to pass racist gerrymandering laws, so that in states where you have more progressive vote than extremists, but more extremists get elected than progressive. It's not Donald Trump that makes it so. Right here in New York, you only have one day of voting. That's voter suppression. In New York, a so-called liberal state, you don't have same-day registration or early voting and more than one day of voting, and you do not have automatic registration to vote, where you get automatically registered to vote at 18, since you can be automatically drafted for war at 18. Listen. There's something else deeper than a person when one candidate wins 3 million more votes than the other and loses because of an electoral college that most of us can never get accepted in. There's something wrong. When a country of immigrants attack immigrants, and when the immigrants attacking the immigrants, if the laws were in place that the immigrants now want in place, their own grandmamas and granddaddy couldn't have got in the country. Something wrong deep down inside. When you have people talking about they want a merit-based system, that's racist. A merit-based system. Go back and check your ancestry. Your ancestors couldn't have merited. Many of the slaves brought over here were more meritorious than your ancestors. When you have a whole system that wants to attack the LGBTQ community, and a lot of times when they get real loud attacking the LGBT community, well, after a while you find out that they were attacking themselves. When you have a society where people want to dismantle and underfund public education and resegregate public education and put billions of dollars into private schools that do not have to accept all people, and when you have a nation that will pour billions of dollars into war without end and will attempt to appoint racist judges to the federal bench that will have lifetime appointment, we have a problem more than just one individual. You have a nation where some will pass a tax bill that represents the single largest transfer of wealth to Americans' elite since the land of the Native Americans was stolen and the labor of 4 million enslaved Africans produced money for the racist aristocracy. And many Republicans have spoken out against the president's tweets and antics, but they still vote for his agenda. Which means they're not really against the agenda, they're just against the antics. And sometimes they like the antics because the antics keep us focused on him rather than what they're doing. They don't object to what he's saying so much as how he says it, because the policies reveal that some of what he says is what they want. Many Democrats, on the other hand, have imagined that Trumpism can be countered by an economic message. Neoliberalism that doesn't even have to address the deep connections between our historical inequality and the rise of white supremacy. In fact, many people think white supremacy is nothing but when you see something happen like what happened in Charlottesville. As bad as that is, as abhorrent as that is, you can actually be a white supremacist and not be hateful. Because white supremacy is about policy. You can be very nice and still be passing very mean policies. You can be a white supremacist and be black. If you understand what white supremacy is and white nationalism and racism is, it's not just about slurs and hatefulness. It's about policy and practice and provision and using power to determine who gets what, when, where, and how. And so, my friends, really, in this moment, you know, the other day some politicians said certain words that President used were just tough talk. And others said, well, it's racist and vulgar. But I want to say he does something worse than what he says. The system is racist
and vulgar that would literally be willing to strip people of opportunity. You see, denying health care is racist because of the disproportionate way in which black and brown people, and mostly poor white people, are hurt. Attacking immigrants is racist. Attacking our brothers and sisters at Standing Rock is racist. Huh? That's right. Denying living wages is racist because 62 million Americans make less than a living wage, but 54% of African Americans make less than a living wage. We have to come to a serious conversation about what racism is. It's not about personal relationship and whether you have a black friend. Not what Dr. King was dealing with. Yeah. And right now, the question is, are we going to live up to the promises, Dr. Forbes, of our democratic creed, or are we going to abandon the illusion of the American project? The moment we're in is not about whether a party is possible. It's not about whether the Democrat party is possible or the Republican party is possible, but about whether America is possible. We are, in fact, I believe, in the birth pains of a third Reconstruction. And America needs more than a new president. We need what Dr. King called a moral revolution of values. If we are willing to receive the diagnosis that Dr. King offered, then there is a way forward for America. But we must know who we are. And we must know that we've been called. We must know that in the 21st century, racism and economic fear still too often conjure a powerful magic, which compels the nation to seek safety in hating the other and security in a false nativism that has failed us before and will fail us again. We are called. We are called. Dr. King is not getting up out of the grave. And just remembering him once a year is not enough. I'm very serious. We are being called. In fact, we can't have another commemoration service and just talk about what he did. We have to begin to follow him and reimagine and do what he did in the times in which we live. Long before the Russians hacked our elections, the American electoral process was compromised by racism and fear. The Southern strategist's 50-year goal of divide and conquer tactics that were developed by Richard Nixon and perfected by George Bush, Strom Thurmond, Jesse Helms, and Ronald Reagan touched something deep in our DNA, an intentional effort to manufacture a solid South and to win over the Rust Belt and some of the Wheat Belt and certain enclaves in the North. Evan Phillips told Richard Nixon, "We can win if we can find a way to make people as mad as George Wallace makes them without using the same language. If we can find a way to divide people, we can win. But we can't use the N-word anymore, so we'll use words like tax cuts, entitlement reform, law and order, huh? And states' rights. And that's what's been used, funded by wealthy oligarchs who use this division to elect candidates that will embrace the false notion of trickle-down economics underneath their race card politics, lining the pockets of the wealthy by fooling working-class white people that their real enemy is black people and brown people. But the reality is we better all get, when you're poor, if you're black or you're white or you're brown or you're red and you can't pay your light bills, we're all black in the dark. Truth of the matter is, we have to face this question. What is it that causes many poor white people, millions of poor, more poor white people than there are poor blacks, to vote against the very programs they need? What makes poor people, what lies are being told to them to vote for a candidate who will promise them they'll be against the LGBT community, be against abortion, be for prayer in the school, but they don't read further and see that those same candidates are against living wages and giving health care and against protecting the environment? What myth will make you vote for somebody who will take your health care when two-thirds of the people losing their health care are the very people that voted for this president? What makes somebody think that allowing your schools to be resegregated is somehow going to help your children? What myth makes people think that privatizing schools with public money is the way to go when you're poor and your child still will not be able to go anyway? What myth is so powerful that it keeps working class, poor white people from building multiracial coalitions together? That's the myth we have to go after. And we have to understand what should bother us so much is not so much about the election of Donald Trump, but how he used the Southern strategy to get elected, and most people didn't know how to call it out. The truth is, right now, America has some possibilities. If we were to register 30% of the African Americans in the South and connect them to working class poor white people and brown people, Alabama wouldn't be an anomaly. You could turn Texas. You could turn Georgia. You could turn North Carolina. You could turn Virginia. I'm not talking about turning it into a party. I'm talking about building a whole new political coalition. It's a mistake to ask how are we going to reach white working class people alone. What we ought to be saying is, how are we going to reach everybody, black and Latino and white? And if we do not deal with the idolatry of race in America and how it connects to everything else we deal with, then we cannot have the kind of radical revolution of values that Dr. King talked about.
We're going to take a short station break, after which we'll continue hearing the words of the Reverend William Barber honoring the social justice and civil liberty work of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, given on January 14th in New York City.
This is 90.7 KBOO. It's 8:35.
Voice from the earth, his blood still cries. No law can kill the dreams we hold. Freedom never dies. It seems I hear Martin's voice from the earth. His blood still cries. No law can kill the dreams we hold. Freedom never dies.
Freedom never dies.
And the artist is Yara Allen, and the song, Freedom Never Dies. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. And you can also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you are still a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Atlanta, Georgia. We now return to the speech given by the Reverend William Barber, where he honored the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s commitment to social justice and civil liberty.
We traveled this past year from Alaska to Alabama, from Charlottesville to Compton, from the Apache Nation to Flint, Michigan. And we've met people of every hue who are hurting, but they're sick and tired of being sick and tired. They feel like it's time now to come together. You saw them, Dr. Forbes. In every community, we are meeting people who know who they are. They are the ones that must come together and shift this nation. And like Jeremiah and King before them, these people are starting to stand up and organize. A mother in Alabama whose daughter died in her arms because she could not get health care because Alabama refused to expand Medicaid said to us, I'm in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. Another young lady from Seattle, Washington, white, has lived homeless. She's standing up. She came to a training we had in Washington and to a mass meeting, and she said this to the whole world with the cameras there. She said, America, I'm the white trash that you threw out but forgot to burn. And I'm joining up with Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris and Reverend Bob and Dr. Forbes to be a part of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. All over this nation, we need it. It wasn't just Dr. King's idea. It was Cesar Chavez and Jewish Federation of Workers and National Welfare Rights Workers and Unitarians and others all over the country and in the nation's capital. We're coming together for a Poor People's Campaign and National Call for a Moral Revival to change the narrative. Because until we change the moral narrative, we cannot deal with the agenda. We have to change. There has to be moral imagination before there will be moral implementation.
And we've got to force America to deal with the issue of systemic poverty, systemic racism, ecological devastation, the war economy, and the distorted moral agenda that's promoted by Christian nationalism and white evangelical that is neither Christian nor evangelical. Dr. King told us the only thing that can ultimately change this country is when you get poor blacks and whites and brown and others to come together. And we must speak truth as to who we are, because there's an entire web of money and influence that's been working to tie up the American democracy, even as the divide between the rich and the poor and the wider is wider ever than our history. Our electorate, however, is growing more diverse. There is a future coming that cannot be denied, but there are those who want to delay it. Wealthy oligarchs know they cannot hold on to power in truly democratic election. So that's why we're witnessing an all-out assault, foreign and domestic. And there comes a time you have to tell the truth. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. And in this moment, it's about whether we as a people can reconstruct the heart of our democracy. And right now we are being called to speak with and for the weak and the voiceless. Dr. King in 68 finally said, the dispossessed of this nation live in a cruelly unjust society. They must organize a revolution. And then the last night when he was with us, he said, nothing would be more tragic than for us to turn back now. This was the voice of our hero in the last year and the hours of his life. This was the revolutionary spirit moving on behalf of the poor and on behalf of the nation. And this, my friend, is our calling. If we really want to say we honor Dr. King and others, this is who we are. We must raise our voices. We must use our feet to march for justice and shape and reshape the conscience of our state and nation. We must use our hand to mark the ballot. I stepped down from the NAACP, and we've been traveling to 15 states testing to see if there a remnant out there. And 37 states have already signed on. And they've said they'll sign on to 40 days of simultaneous action. Simultaneous civil disobedience, simultaneous direct action, simultaneous public education about building power, and simultaneous voter mobilization in 25 state capitals and the District of Columbia as a minimum. Over 1,000 people organized in every state, joining in mass civil disobedience and agenda-based civil disobedience, rooted in something called the Souls of Poor Folk, auditing America 50 years after the March on Washington. And why we're coming together is not to address the health of one person, but the health of the nation. What we are seeing, the person in the White House and the cadre of politicians, what we're seeing is that they will do anything to ensure the greedy transfer of tax dollars. But these are the symptoms of our nation's moral anemia. And it's a reminder of that great spiritual text, for the love of money is the root of all evil. And so as it has been before, it must be now. We must have a moral movement. We must have eternal hostility toward any system that keeps people in poverty. Dr. Forbes in my church last week said he didn't care if it was capitalism, socialism, or communism. If it keeps people in poverty, it is sin. It is something wrong. It is something wrong with a heretical moral narrative that has pity on billionaires and says nothing about the painful dehumanizing structures that cause poverty and undergirds racism. And so we must use our pulpits to sound the alarm. I want to believe that every preacher that came here and read scripture is ready to go to jail now. Huh? We must turn our lawyers to a loose to fight in the courts, because the Constitution still lives. And we, the faithful, must be reminded that we are not called to be the servants of the state, but the conscience of the state. We are called to be the moral guardians of community. And in times like these, we must remember that we are called to be a prophetic witness. God demands that we stand for justice. God demands by the Spirit that we care for the brokenhearted, the captive, and the blind, and the oppressed. Didn't you hear what he said
said to Jeremiah 2600 years ago, when Jeremiah faced a king that was a narcissistic tower builder and egotist as well. He said, go down to the king's house. Tell him to attend to matters of justice, set things right between the people, rescue victims from their exploiter, and stop taking advantage of people and stop passing laws that murder people. This is our faith. Our faith is a faith in action. Faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. By faith, we have the courage to be. By faith, we go from strength to strength. By faith, the plans to kill us make us alive. By faith, we go through trouble and we never let trouble overwhelm us. By faith, we never give up believing. By faith, we never let sorrow immobilize us. We never let pain invalidate us. We never let challenges turn us. We never let danger defeat us. By faith, in the face of frontal attacks on our rights, we are called to change situations and not accept them. We are called to stand up and not to bow down to Pharaoh or to Nebuchadnezzar or to Goliath. By faith, handicapped people can participate in holy miracles, because faith in God is more powerful than any concern, more powerful than any foe, more powerful than any president or any problem. Yes, these are tough times. The mean and the greedy are cocky on every side. Never before in recent history have we seen so much money, pornographic sums of money being spent in the resistance to the cause of equality. Yes, these are troubling times, but by faith, we don't give up to evil. Faith stands up. Faith speaks truth to power. I wish I had a witness here. Faith, faith, I tell you. Faith. Faith. Faith refuses to be the chattel slavery of the property of injustice. Faith. Faith is knowing that when God helps you, there's no challenge that can't be met. There's no mountain that can't be climbed. There's no valley that can't be crossed. There's no enemy that can't be defeated. There's no darkness that can't be overcome. There's no pressure that can't be pushed through. There's no political power that can't be overturned. I tell you, I feel like preaching right now. I'm sorry. But seems like I hear the Mississippi Mass Choir singing, hold on to your faith, and saying Satan is busy stirring up wrath, gathering stones to block my path. Our enemies inflicting all the hurt they can by throwing their rocks and hiding their hand. But you dig one ditch, you better dig two, because the trap you set for me might just be for you. Hold on to your faith. We must hold on to our faith and say and declare that our rights ordained by God and guaranteed by the Constitution, we will never give up on them. We will never turn back. One election can't turn us back. One loud mouth can't turn us back. George Wallace couldn't turn us back. Bull Connor couldn't turn us back. Our faith might get bruised and battered. Our hope for this nation, however, is that we're going to keep it moving forward. We might get discouraged, but we'll never lose our faith. If I was home, I ain't home, I'm in this sedated, big old northern church. But if I were home, I'd say weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. These modern day racists must not know who we are. McConnell must not know who we are. Ryan must not know who we are. The funders must not know who we are. We are the sons and daughters of Martin. We are the sons and daughters of Rabbi Heschel. We are the sons and daughters of Rosa Parks and Dorothy Day and Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and Fannie Lou Hamer and William Lloyd Garrison. Who are we? We are the sons of Abraham and Sarah and Muhammad and Ali and Moses and Jesus and Mary. We were born for right now. We've already made it through 250 years of slavery and another 100 years of Jim Crow. By faith, we've already made it through the Holocaust. By faith, we watched you kill our leader, but you killed him, but you didn't kill the dream. And by faith, we can take your sugar honey iced tea hole and turn it into fertilizer. We can turn it into fertilizer and build a brand new movement. So we must go down to the U.S. Capitol and every state capital until the cries of the poor are heard. We must go down until the nation knows that it's not a crime to be poor, but poverty is a sin before Almighty God. We must go down until every sick person has access to health care and every worker a living wage and every child a constitutional, diverse, fully funded public education and the poor have a guaranteed income. We must go down and refuse to believe that nobody can change. We must go down until our leaders commit to divest from the war economy and reinvest in a war on poverty. We must go down until the false prophets of hate are overwhelmed by the glad tidings of the beloved community. We must go down until those with power are converted and some of our adversaries become our friends. We must go down with love and truth. We must go down no matter what the challenges are. We've got to go down, y'all. Black and white and brown and young and old and gay and straight and Jew and Christian and Muslim and Hindu and people not of faith but who believe in a moral universe and natives and elders and immigrants, and that's why we're linking up from Mother's Day to the summer solstice all over this country and in the District of Columbia. We're going down to the people's house in 25 states. I hope some of you will sign up to go. You got a card in your bulletin, and I hope you will say that we're going down and we're going to pledge eternal hostility to the systemic violence of the status quo and racism and poverty and ecological devastation and the war economy. We're going down to shock the heart of this nation, and while we're going all over this nation, we're going to be singing what Martin and Viola Wusa and Fannie Lou Hamer and others sang. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is tramping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He will loose the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. The God I serve, he has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never sound retreat. He is sifting out the heart of men before the judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. Glory! Glory! Glory!
And those were powerful words of the Reverend William Barber on the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s commitment to social justice and civil liberty, given at a church in New York City, the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church, on January 14th, 2018. And now we're going to hear a very recent speech given by the Reverend William Barber. Indeed, we're going to wrap up our show with Reverend Barber's words spoken on April 4th, 2018 from the balcony of the Lorraine Hotel, where 50 years ago, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Let us hear now from Reverend Barber.
One writer has said in a recent book that movements are not cozy spaces for movement builders and leaders. And during the Southern Freedom Movement, white segregationists turned the landscape in the South into a bloody battleground, and jails, balconies, and private homes and streets into sites of terror and killing fields. These were the realities of the people in the movement and what they faced, and Dr. King was no exception. The weight of these years, by the time he got to Memphis to stand with black men who were organizing a garbage strike, were heavy. By the time he got to Memphis, he had racists, moderates, politicians, a president, and even jealous criticism from black leaders who used his position against the Vietnam War as an excuse to diminish his status in the eyes of liberal white America while raising their own. And then the bullet rang and his body fell. Often we call Dr. King's last sermon the mountaintop sermon, but actually it wasn't. It was a call to action in the valley of poverty and racism. And he was dealing with racism and poverty and militarism when he stopped by Memphis to stand with garbage workers. He saw the connection between all three and knew that you could not address one without addressing the other. And that's why before he ever said anything about the mountaintop, he said, "We must give ourselves to this struggle until the end, and nothing would be more tragic than for us to stop at this point. We must go up together or go down together."
And what he said then is what we must do now. Nothing would be more tragic than for us to turn back now when the Voting Rights Act has been gutted and we have less voting rights today than we had in 1965. And for 1,745 days, the Congress has refused to fix the Voting Rights Act. 23 states have passed racist voter suppression laws. We have 140 million poor and working poor in this country, 62 million working poor people, 14 million children, and we lock people up who fight for 15 while we let corporate crooks go every day. Nothing would be more tragic than for us to turn back now. And right here in Memphis, this majority black southern city, is the most impoverished metropolitan area in the nation. Nearly 20% of its residents living below the poverty line. The sanitation workers still don't have a living wage and guaranteed kinds of incomes and benefits. Nothing would be more tragic than for us to turn back now. Tennessee has 1.4 million poor people in it, mostly white, mostly women, mostly children, and the governor and the legislature have refused to pass living wage but have passed voter suppression, and you have some politicians who are so arrogant they will stand on a stage and say they honor Dr. King while every day they dishonor him with policy. We have 37 million people without health care in America. 63 cents of every discretionary dollar is going for war. Nothing would be more tragic than for us to be turned back now. We treat corporations like people and people like things. Corporations are allowed to poison our water, our air, and our land. And you can buy unleaded gas in Flint, Michigan, but you can't get unleaded water. Thousands of people die every day from policy, what Coretta Scott King called policy violence. Black people are shot in the street by police, and others, and many other people die from low wealth and low income. Nothing would be more tragic than for us now. So we must be the resurrection. When we face a time where even today, the president is talking about the military on the Mexican border, on the day we are honoring the general of nonviolence, nothing would be more tragic than for us to be turned back now. And so as I close, the Bible says, woe unto those who love the tombs of the prophet. You don't want to love the tomb of a prophet. The only way you can honor a prophetic leader and a prophetic movement is to reach down in the blood and pick up the baton, not just the baton of Martin, but of all the martyrs, black, white, brown, red, and yellow, and then carry that baton the rest of the way. We must declare, as we come to this place, that there is power in the blood. That is why thousands are coming together to launch 40 days from Mother's Day forward, a season of nonviolent fusion, moral direct action, a season of voter mobilization, and a season of power building called the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. Who's joining? A woman whose daughter died in Alabama because Alabama refused to expand Medicaid. White women from Appalachia, chiefs from the Apache Nation, Latino men and women from El Paso, men who are working, poor working, veterans of war, and people who are fighting for voting rights. The people are coming together to decide that we don't need another commemoration. We need a reconsecration. We don't need another remembrance. We need a moral revival in America. We don't need to just remember the blood. We need to reach down in the blood because there's power in the blood. And that's why Liz Theo Harris is here with me as the co-chair, because there's power in the blood. There's power when you stand on the shoulders of the martyrs. There's power when you refuse to go back. There's power when you won't turn around. There's power when you focus on love and truth and justice. And the truth is, even if one falls in one generation, we can pick it up in another generation. So let us declare that we are soldiers in the army. We've got to hold up the bloodstained banner. And we've got to hold it up until we die. No matter what Trump does, hold it up. No matter what racists do, hold it up. No matter what injustice does, hold it up. We've got to hold it up until we die. We've got to hold it up until every vote is protected, until every person is respected, until every person has health care. We've got to hold it up until every child is lifted in love. We've got to hold it up until every job is a living wage job. We've got to hold it up until every person in poverty has guaranteed subsistence. We've got to hold it up until every black man or woman is free from being shot unarmed by the police. We've got to hold it up until every war is ceased and every wall is torn down and every immigrant is welcome and every lying preacher that tries to pray for presidents while they are praying, P-R-E-Y-I-N-G, on the poor and the hurting. We've got to hold it up even if we have a narcissistic egomaniac in the White House. We've got to hold it up. We've got to hold it up. We've got to hold it up. That power. Power, power, power in the blood.
We're out of time. I would like to thank the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival, for making these speeches available to the public. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, Sherelle Withers, our intern, Stephanie Case, our assistant producer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson, and all who helped to make this show possible. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. You can go online to the Poor People's Campaign, A National Call for Moral Revival, for more information on that campaign. Stay tuned for Rising Up. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Mark.
Good morning. The time is 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, we have Press Watch, followed by Air Cascadia at 10 o'clock, interviews, news, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers with David Naiman speaks to Cheston Knapp about his new essay collection, Up, Up, Down. At 11:30, Words and Pictures will take you away. Here comes the story of the hurricane.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host a class, Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m. here at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally, nationally, and at KBOO. We'll explore how hip hop influences art, culture, and political